What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Featuring Joe Sweeney from Thinking Sideways podcast and filmmaker Vincent Caldoni, this is The Shocking Details.
Hey there. Welcome to another episode of The Shocking Details. I'm Joe, joined as usual by
Vincent Caldoni.
Got something fairly shocking for you this week. I was, this is actually another World War II mystery, and it's part of a story that a lot of you might have heard of. More of you will have heard more about it here pretty quickly, because there's a movie coming out about this story, but we're going to talk about an aspect of it that the movie is probably not going to talk about.
Likely,
I would think not. We're talking, of course, about Operation Mincemeat, which is also the title of the new movie coming out.
Not a sponsored episode, by the way, but you guys should be sponsoring us.
It is not. No, and I saw on Netflix that they made this movie and they're going to release it in a couple of weeks. I thought, you know, I've already read two books about this story and I have my own thoughts about the whole thing. We should just get them out there for people to, you know, to see, right? Mm-hmm. I think so. Yeah. And by the way, you can listen to this episode. I don't think it's going to spoil the movie for you. I really don't.
No more than history will.
Yeah, I know. Well, anyway, so Mincemeat, Operation Mincemeat was a major deception operation against Germany conducted by the British government in World War II.
Really cool one, too.
It is a cool one. It's extremely cool. That's why I hate to cast doubt upon the whole thing, which we're going to do here, because there is a little mystery about the whole thing. So let's, first of all, we'll give everybody a little background on Operation Mincemeat itself. Mm-hmm. So, Vincent, you want to lead us into this?
You know I do.
Oh, of course you do. I know.
Our story begins in 1943 after Rommel's defeat in North Africa, which we talked about in a previous episode, actually.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
Yeah. And after the Allies took over, they began thinking about what they were going to do with all the Mediterranean waterfront real estate they just acquired. And the obvious thing, of course, was to use that as a springboard for an invasion into Southern Europe.
That's what I would have done. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The German military was thinking about this as well. The Allies, of course, obviously were going to make a move. Question is where were they going to attack? One school of thought said Sardinia. You know, go take a look at a map if you're not familiar with the Mediterranean. Sardinia is west of Italy and north of Sicily. So, you know, sort of floating out there in the middle of the Mediterranean. Sardinia. So it was a likely target because it was lightly defended, difficult to reinforce, and they could mount an invasion of the island relatively quickly because of its proximity to North Africa. And mm-hmm. It was in a very good position for bombing operations against southern Germany and Italy as well. But on the other hand, Sardinia did not have enough harbors or beaches to allow for a large number of ground troops to land, or at least
that makes quickly. Sense. It's a very rocky country.
Yeah. So let's see, what are our other options?
Well, Sicily, I think, would probably be the other obvious one.
Sicily would be good. Yeah.
It's got plenty of harbors and beaches. It's a shipping area, has been for centuries. Mm-hmm. It's also close enough to North Africa. Sardinia's a little further from North Africa. So that puts them within striking distance of the Allied short-range fighter planes. And an occupation of Sicily would potentially knock the Italians out of the war altogether.
That would be
Sicily would also allow control of the waters of the Mediterranean itself. Look at a map, you'll see that it's very centrally located.
Yeah, right smack dab in the middle, actually.
Right. So on its northeast end, it's only like just a little over 2 miles to the Italian boot. You can actually see it sometimes. You can see Italy from Sicily and vice versa. On its western end, though, it's only about 90 miles to Tunisia. So whoever controls that island can bisect the Mediterranean. This is a strategy that actually went back to the time of like Julius Caesar and stuff.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. Yeah. But on the other end, there's a third target, possible. Hitler and the German Armed Forces High Command thought that the Allies were most likely to strike at Greece in the Balkans to the north of Greece. Mm. They considered Greece more vulnerable to attack because it was more difficult to reinforce, for one thing. And the Balkans, of course, were essential to the German war effort. They supplied Germany with oil, bauxite, and copper.
Mm-hmm. So you need those for some war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Greece actually would have been a good target.
Yeah, so, which is kind of surprising. I guess the pushback on that is that's a lot of island hopping, which is we learned in the Pacific or would learn in the Pacific is challenging.
Well, that's it. If they had, invaded the Peloponnese, which is what they would have done, the Peloponnesian Peninsula, it's this big blob at the bottom of that's separated. It's an isthmus that is separated by a tiny little neck of land from the rest of Greece. And so, you know, logistically speaking, You can take the peninsula, but then going on from there would be kind of a pain. It could be done. Yeah. But
Mussolini, he was in the Sicily camp, as was Field Marshal Kesselring, head of the German forces in the Mediterranean. And they were right. The Allies were going to go for Sicily.
They sure were.
So the question for the Allies was, how do you build up forces to invade Sicily without alerting the Germans and the Italians about what you're up to? A few deception plans were cooked up, including a massive but mostly fake troop and vehicle buildups in Syria and Egypt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of like what we did in England prior to invading Normandy on D-Day. Yeah, similar, you know, fake tanks and trucks and stuff like
that. And it had like inflatable tanks. There's some really cool pictures of like two guys carrying a tank around.
I know. And so they were doing the same thing in the Middle East, over to the east and the eastern end of it, to give the impression they were getting ready to invade Greece, which of course they weren't. Mm-hmm. So the idea for this deception that eventually grew into Operation Mincemeat was in the famous Trout Memo, which was co-authored by none other than Ian Fleming. He may have heard of that guy.
Yeah, he was the inventor of James Bond.
Exactly. Fleming worked for Naval Intelligence, and he had read a novel called The Milliner's Hat Mystery by one Basil Thompson, in which the body of a dead man is found and it has documents in its pockets, which in the end turned out to be forged and deliberately planted on the corpse. So he threw this idea into the Trout Memo, and the Trout Memo was a series of proposals for deceiving the Germans. The Trout Memo was circulated to the 20 Committee, which you have all heard of, I'm sure, right?
Yeah. I don't know what that was.
Yeah. Now, the 20 Committee ran counterintelligence in wartime Britain. And there's actually a lot of interesting stuff that they did. And I've actually got a book that was written by the head of it, John Masterman, floating around here somewhere. It's kind of an intelligence classic. And I'll loan it to you sometime.
Can't wait.
Promise not to get chocolate fingerprints all over it, okay? But
no promises.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, back to the 20 Committee. Two of the members of this committee were Ewan Montagu and Charles Cholmondeley. These two characters were tasked with implementing the idea of planting some fake documents on a dead body for the Germans to find.
Right. Okay? Right.
Yeah.
So they created a character, Major William Marshall. And they set up fleshing out Martin? His personality. Yeah, Martin Marshall. It's all the same. Sorry. They created a character Major William Marshall, and they set about
you
fleshing
said it
out
again.
His. Why do I keep saying Marshall? I don't know what my deal is. Okay, all right, I'm going to get it right this time. Otherwise, you're taking this paragraph.
Yeah, that's right. If you screw it up, I'm doing it. Damn it.
They created a character, Major William Martin, and set about fleshing out his personality. Martin had a fiance, of course. Her name was Pam, and they created love letters from her that would, of course, be found in Martin's pockets. Ewan Montague's secretary, Jean Leslie, provided a picture of herself at the seashore, which also wound up in Martin's pockets.
That's right. She got to play the part of Pam.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was also a letter from his fictional father, one J.C. Martin, written on the letterhead of the Black Lion Hotel in Wales, where he mentions, without explaining why in the letter, he is on an extended stay. This was done so the Germans wouldn't have an address to go looking for the real J.C. Martin at. Smart.
Yeah,
also, probably J.C. Martin helps confuse it. So it's not like, you know, John Charles Marshall or Martin or whatever.
And, Martin is also a fairly common name.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Like, it'll take him a while to run down all of the J.C. Martins out there and see who has a kid in the military. Like, that's really complicated if you're doing that from a foreign hostile country.
It is kind of. And actually, another reason they picked the last name Martin is because they were aware through Bletchley Park intercepts of communications that the Germans had a list of all of every officer in the British military, but they only had A through L. M through Z they didn't have yet. And so they picked something that started with M, knowing that they wouldn't be able to just consult their list. Although there was at least a couple of William Martins actually in the British military at the time.
Right, right.
Yeah. What else? There was also another nice little detail. There was a letter from William Martin's bank demanding that he make good on an overdraft. And the letter, this is a great little detail here, was wrongly addressed originally to Martin at the Army and Navy Club in London. Hmm. And the envelope was returned to the bank with the note written on the front, not known at this address. Try Navy and Military Club, 94 Piccadilly, which was where the fictional Martin was staying. So, and the envelope had even been postmarked twice. So, good detail. The letter ostensibly, of course, reached Major Martin the second time because it was in his pocket. And yeah, so these guys, Montague and Cholmondeley, really paid attention to detail, I think. And actually, a lot more detail than we're going to go into here. We just want to give you a flavor of how painstakingly they built this character up. I mean, down to his underwear. I mean, they did everything, every little detail. And if you want all the details, we'll have some book recommendations later on for you.
And a movie recommendation.
And a movie recommendation as well.
So there was one problem. They needed a dead body. They needed a corpse.
Yeah.
But this is maybe not so hard to come by in these days.
Yeah, well, they needed someone male. A corpse is not all shot to hell.
That's true. Deal. They needed someone male of military age.
Yeah.
The plan was to put a top secret letter in a briefcase that they would then handcuff to Major Martin's body. This letter was from Lieutenant General Archibald Nye, Vice Chief of the Imperial General Staff in London, to General Harold Alexander, the senior British officer in Tunisia. Nye's letter discussed Allied intentions in Southern Europe. American and British forces were going to cross the Mediterranean from North Africa and launch attacks on German-held Greece and Sardinia. That's the plan.
Yeah. But so far, there was no Major Martin military courier to handcuff the briefcase to. Montague and Cholmondeley briefly considered doing a little Burke and Hare, mistakenly believing that Burke and Hare were grave robbers, which is actually
okay. I thought they were going to kill somebody.
Yeah, I know exactly. No.
When you read that, I was like, oh God, I didn't know they considered that. That's really dark.
Yeah, no, they were talking about, you know, robbing a fresh grave. But Burke and Hare, as you all know, if you listen to us, they never actually dug up any graves at all.
They were too lazy for that.
But the idea of grave robbing was fairly appalling to them. So instead, they went to one Bentley Purchase, great name, by the way, who was a coroner at St. Pancras in London. And Bentley Purchase, of course, had access to fresh corpses. So Montague met with him and explained the need for a fresh dead body, which would give the appearance of having died of either drowning or in an air crash, because that was the plan, is they were going to fake that this person, this Major Martin had been in a transport plane which had crashed in the ocean. This is why his body was floating in the ocean for the Germans to find. So Bentley Purchase, coroner, promised to keep his eyes open. And he was actually, he was actually a little reluctant at first because, but eventually they explained that it was there was a dire need for secrecy as well. And Montague actually lied just a little bit, you know, and he's, you know, he actually implied strongly that that this went all the way up to Churchill, that Churchill himself had approved of the stealing of a corpse from a London morgue. Which he hadn't quite done, but, you know, it all worked out okay in the end.
January 25th, 1943, Montague had his dead body. The evening before, a young homeless Welshman named, Glendower Michael had gone into an empty warehouse in London and swallowed a large dose of rat poison. And the body had been put into cold storage.
So there you go.
Eventually, Glendower Michael was taken out of the fridge and dressed in a military uniform. His pockets were stuffed with those very convincing letters and all those other things.
Yeah, and like some canceled theater tickets and, you know, book of matches.
Lots of interesting.
All kinds of whatever you'd find in somebody's pocket, you know.
The story was to be that he was flying on a military transport which crashed into the Atlantic just off the coast of Spain. When the body washed ashore, the Spaniards would find it and hopefully let the Germans take a peek at the contents of the briefcase. Spain was, of course, officially neutral in the war, but there were a lot of German sympathizers in the Spanish military and the government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, of course, the body was not loaded onto a plane. Instead, it was put on a submarine, the Seraph, which transported it south and put it into the water just off the town of Huelva, Spain. Which is, FYI, northwest of Gibraltar and not too far east from Portugal, kind of down in the southwest corner of Spain. And they picked it mostly because they consulted with their experts and figured that that was the best place for currents that would carry it towards the shore rather than away from the shore. The last thing they wanted was to go to all this hassle, put the body in the water, it just goes out to sea, and nobody ever finds it. That would truly suck.
Just ends up on Cape Cod a year and a half later.
Yeah. Oops. Yeah.
So the wallet on the body identified...
Wait. You missed a paragraph there.
Within a day, a fisherman found the body and took it ashore. But now comes the tricky part.
Mm-hmm.
The wallet on the body identified it as Major William Martin, the Royal Marines. The Spanish authorities called in the British Vice Consul, Francis Hazelden, and the Spaniards offered the case and its contents to Hazelden. But let's Hazelden see. Said,
yeah.
Yeah, that was not what they wanted to happen. But yeah. Hazelden said no and asked that the handover of the case and body go through formal channels, which must have been odd for the Spanish, right? It's, you know, that he wouldn't want to just take the case. But of course, them keeping it for at least a little while longer was key to the plan. If he just took it, then the Germans weren't going to get their crowdy little eyes on the contents.
Yeah. And then when you think about it, Hazelden's refusal to take the briefcase could have easily blown the operation right there. I mean, he had little choice. I don't know precisely what his words were. Something like, oh, no, we must do this precisely the perfect bureaucratic way. You must hang on to that plus the body and turn them all together at once, you know, or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know that they really anticipated the Spaniards were just going to say, hey, do you want the briefcase? And so he handled it as well as could be expected under the circumstances, I think.
Yeah, you'd almost think you'd want to do reverse psychology.
Yeah.
And be like, I'm sending a convoy over there to collect Major Martin's body immediately. Do not show anyone.
Yeah.
Especially no Germans or German sympathizers who have cameras.
Well, they did actually do something kind of similar to that. Because for several days after that, the British authorities in London sent a series of increasingly frantic messages to Hazelden in Spain asking about the whereabouts of Major Martin's briefcase.
And
of course, these messages were meant to be intercepted and decoded by the Germans.
Right, exactly.
Which they were, you know. And so the Germans no doubt figured out that, hey, there must be something kind of important in that briefcase, you know.
I
believe at this point, it's a whole complicated story about, you know, the Germans essentially the Abwehr branch that was in Madrid contacting local friendly Germans and asking if they could possibly help him out by, you know, getting a hold of this case and maybe letting them look at the letters or documents or whatever is in this case. And that basically is what happened. Mm-hmm. So again, this is a, you know, this is a, not just a daring plan, but it's just, when you think about it, there's so many ways that the whole thing could have gone south.
That's what I would worry about.
Yeah. There was a lot of variables here and a lot of places for things to go wrong.
The briefcase was eventually handed over. And with the contents intact, none of the letters had been opened, but the Spaniards had sneakily extracted the letters from their envelopes and shown them to the Germans and then put them back.
Yeah, when the case, professionally done. Yeah.
When the case got back to London, it was confirmed that letters had been read. This is such an odd detail. They'd folded an eyelash into one of them, and it was gone.
Perfect. I love it. Yeah.
Perfect. It appeared to the Germans that the Brits believed they'd gotten their letters back without anyone seeing their contents. And the Brits were all too happy to let them think that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that was also key to the plan is that, you know, it's the key to the plan is that the Brits cannot find out that the Germans saw those letters. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's, So Operation Mincemeat worked quite well. Hitler shifted an entire panzer division to Greece and also reinforced Sardinia. When the Allies invaded Sicily, they had a pretty easy task. Although it's easy for me to say, I'm sitting here not getting shot at. It could have been a hell of a lot harder, though. But
I guess that's true, yeah.
Yeah, it could have been a lot worse. But Operation Husky, which was the code name for the invasion of Sicily, began on July 9th, 1943, and the island was secured within about 5 weeks. So history, and you know, of course, Hitler was foiled again. Ha ha. Yes.
But Mincemeat might not have been the overwhelming success everyone thinks it was. I mean, yeah, it fooled the right people, so the plan, for all intents and purposes, worked. But it's not 100% clear that everyone on the German side was totally taken in. And that is the key to our mystery here. Did the success of Montague's daring plan in the end depend on the kindness of a few select enemy strangers?
Yeah.
That's what we're wondering about.
That is the question, huh? First, I think we need to hear a word from our sponsors.
Oh, because they're such awesome sponsors.
Oh, we love them. Yeah, they're great. We love buy them. Their stuff. Yeah.
Buy two of them.
Just,
whatever
it is. Yeah, don't just buy it once. Go back again and again and again, even if you don't need it. Yeah.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get one-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we're back. Hope you enjoyed those commercials. Now, to talk about this mystery of ours, again, we're talking about, like, did everybody in the German government and military believe that this incredible intelligence find, that this incredible fluke that had brought this corpse in a briefcase into their hands and given them a direct peek into the brains of the Brits and the Allies and what they were planning on doing? Did everybody buy into that? Apparently so, but maybe not. But the important thing, you know, was convincing Hitler. It did seem to work for that. Mm-hmm. So let's see. Let's see. Who was possibly not convinced here?
To start with, there was the Abwehr chief in Spain, Wilhelm Leisner. The Spaniards, after the Spaniards extracted the letters from their envelopes, they were taken to the German embassy in Madrid and handed in person to Leisner. The courier told him that he had 1 hour to look at them. Meisner took them down to the basement of the embassy and had a photographer take photos of them. The originals were handed back to the Spanish courier. Leisner recognized the importance of the documents. They basically laid bare the Allied plan to invade Greece and possibly Sardinia, with Sicily as a decoy target. But Leisner...
Those sneaky Brits.
I know. He wasn't dumb. He knew...
Yeah.
Something struck him as being a little off here. He wrote his diary, and this is a quote here. Why don't you read the quote? This is what he wrote his diary.
All right, quote. These letters... I'm not going to do a German accent, by the way. But
you would.
Yeah. Oh, I can if you want. These letters mention the operational name Husky. No, excellent. Okay, I'm going to do it in English. Quote, these letters mentioned the operational name Husky. That stuck in my memory because it seemed to me a dangerous thing to name the code word in the same document as discussed the possible destinations, unquote. In other words, he was saying, yeah, what the hell? This is a dumb move. I mean, seriously? Yeah.
Yeah.
So he apparently smelled a rat.
It looked too good sometimes.
He also said at the time that it really would be unwise to draw any firm conclusions from a single letter that they just happened to find. Probably wise. Yeah.
Well, luckily for the Allies, no one was listening to Leisner. The opinions of the fair-haired boy, Karl Erich Kuhlenthal, seemed to carry more weight by 1943. Kuhlenthal was the second in command of the Abwehr in Spain. But he was a protege of and a favorite of Wilhelm Canaris, head of the Abwehr, and he had essentially superseded Leisner in all but title, mostly due to his spectacular success as a spy master, which is odd.
He was amazing. He was a wunderkind, as the Germans say.
I guess maybe he was better at spying on Spanish people, because he had Kuhlenthal had agents all over the Iberian Peninsula and one really important agent in Britain. Mm-hmm. The Abwehr considered him to be one of their most successful agents.
His agent in Britain actually is a fairly famous one, codenamed by the British Garbo. But there's been books written about Garbo.
I've definitely heard about one Pujol.
Yeah, but a lot of his agents, turns out, were bogus. The guy in Britain was a Spaniard named Juan Pujol Garcia, who, as I mentioned, was codenamed Garbo by the Brits. Garcia approached the Abwehr in Madrid in 1941, saying he was going to go to Britain and that he wanted to spy for Germany. Kuhlenthal put him off at first, but he was won over by Garcia's obvious hatred of Britain, his love of Hitler. So Garcia was recruited. He was given instruction in writing in secret ink and other communications methods, handed a bunch of English currency, and sent off to London to spy for Germany.
Garcia was a prolific agent and soon began submitting detailed and useful reports, which Kuhlenthal passed along to Berlin. But Garcia never actually set foot in Britain. And it turns out he didn't really love Hitler either. And when he left Spain, he moved to Portugal and began assembling bogus reports from travel guides, magazines, newspapers, and newsreels. His reports were actually full of errors, but Kuhlenthal didn't know any better, and he believed him, so it worked.
Yeah. So the question is, was Kuhlenthal really so credulous? Or was he deliberately trying to undermine the Nazi war effort? Historians have wondered about this. No one really knows for sure.
Yeah,
his mentor, Wilhelm Canaris, who we mentioned earlier, turned out in the end to be somewhat less than enthusiastic about Hitler and the Nazis himself. So was he staffing the Abwehr with anti-Hitler personnel who would help him sabotage the war effort? This is something I've wondered about in other venues, and about the Abwehr's performance in World War II. It was really kind of pathetic. And I've kind of wondered if their hearts were really in it, and maybe not. So it's conceivable that Kuhlenthal was not on board with Nazi ideology, since he was, after all, one quarter Jewish.
That's crazy.
Or maybe he was totally on board with it, but just a lousy spy. It's been said also, though, but given his Jewish roots, that he really, really wanted to keep his posting in Spain, and he would do anything to avoid going back to Germany. And so that might have, that might explain it too. It wasn't so much that he was trying to sabotage the Germans, but he just didn't really give a damn. He just wanted to keep his job in Spain because, you know, he just, you know, it would have been a risky proposition to go back to Germany. Or, you know, it's possible, who knows? Maybe it might be he really was just a credulous dupe, but maybe Canaris recruited him simply because he realized he was a credulous dupe who would be easily manipulated by the enemy. So he didn't.
That's why I've always seen him presented.
So I don't know. It's you know, the history books are still kind of uncertain on this one.
That's pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
So, by the way, Juan Pujol Garcia was eventually recruited by MI5, which makes sense because he was already doing their work.
Yeah.
They were intercepting his messages and were alarmed that there was an agent operating in Britain that they didn't know about. But in 1942, they made him. They identified and realized his value, though.
Yeah.
They took him to Britain and put him in a house in London. And for the next 3 years, Garcia, codenamed Garbo, also by the Brits, sent hundreds of messages and letters back to Spain. All of the intel was carefully constructed by a team of MI5 officers, though. Agent Garbo was actually a huge success for MI5.
Yeah, he was, and a huge benefit to the war effort. Again, there's been books written about Garbo, so
yeah,
lots of information out there if you're interested. And also, Garbo was a huge success for Kulenthal in a way, even though he was passing along pure BS to Berlin. And Agent Garbo, in reality, was a disaster for German intelligence. Everybody in Berlin was buying it. And so Kulenthal's star was rising even faster in Berlin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, by the way, was really helpful in terms for Operation Mincemeat. Because he was the guy who flew to Berlin with the photographs of the secret documents and presented them. And as been said, you know, in intelligence, you know, as in many other aspects of life, presentation is everything.
Sure. So gave it a big multiplier with Kulenthal.
Yeah, exactly. So when your favorite fair-haired boy, this incredible, as I said, wunderkind, shows up with this incredible intelligence bonanza, you're more inclined to believe it.
Right. Right. Yeah. Exactly. The Brits noticed something else, though.
Oh yeah. Let's get back to Kulenthal for just a moment. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is funny.
Yeah. Oh, I could talk about Pujol Garcia all night. The Brits noticed that they were intercepting Kulenthal's reports through Bletchley Park. And those are the guys who built the Enigma machine. There's been like books and films about that.
Well, they didn't build the Enigma machine. They deconstructed one and reverse engineered it into a massive computer that would help them decipher Enigma messages.
Right.
And of course, everybody's heard about that. It's really an amazing thing.
Just put it in there. It's pretty amazing. They noticed that Kulenthal was actually adding stuff to Garcia's reports. He was inventing subagents and reporting stuff that was just obviously made up.
Yeah.
So it appears that at the very least, Kulenthal wasn't very concerned with the quality of the information he was sending out.
No, it really doesn't, does it? So that does tell you. I mean, maybe it does lend a little bit of credence, I think, to the theory that maybe Carl Erich Kulenthal was not so much incompetent. Maybe he was on the other side. And as we mentioned before, he was one quarter Jewish, so it really would be understandable if the channel my inner Brit, if he endeavored to toss a spanner into Hitler's plans.
Yeah.
Don't you think? Yeah.
It would make sense, although, I just say, having worked for a semi-governmental agency for a lot of my life, just never underestimate how dumb these guys can be.
Oh, I know. Yeah. Yeah, so as to the question of was he fooled by Operation Mincemeat, I truly don't know. I really don't know. He probably was fooled, but I wouldn't bet the farm on it.
Imagine how dumb you'd have to be to sit around thinking you could just sit around lying to Hitler for 3 years or whatever.
Well, that's it. It was kind of a risky proposition, you know, because if you get busted with, you know, if your information turns out to be so bogus that, you know, but apparently he never got called on it. So lucky for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what do we got here? Wilhelm Leissner and maybe Carl Erich Kulenthal were not taken in by Operation Mincemeat, at least not 100%. Who else? So our next guy is the really important one.
Okay.
This was Lieutenant Colonel Alexis Baron von Rohm, head of Foreign Armies West, also called FHW, that's a German acronym, which was the a military intelligence arm of the Abwehr, and a very important, actually more important than the Abwehr itself.
And we should also give a shout out here to Ben McIntyre, a British journalist who has written quite a few books on intelligence. You've read several of his books, including Operation Mincemeat, right?
Oh yeah, I've got a copy of that and some of his other books as well. Yeah, he's written a lot of books, mostly concerning World War II, Cold War kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. He wrote a nice biography of Kim Philby, which I have in my collection. I have not yet gotten around to reading that yet because, unfortunately, I have less time for pleasure reading these days because I'm busy reading about mysteries and cool stuff to, you know, share with you people. So I have less time for just, you know.
I have a book about science I've been really wanting to get into, but I can't, there's no way I can make it into an episode. And I it's just sitting on my coffee table haunting me.
Yeah, I know the feeling, man. But anyway, yeah. So Ben McIntyre is good. I've got several of his books and he's worth reading. And I also have a copy of Ewan Montague's book because it turns out he wrote a book about this little escapade. His book is called The Man Who Never Was. And obviously we've drawn most of our information from these two books.
Yeah.
Although there's other information out there, of course. There's plenty of information, but these two books are really the place to go. Montague's book was written in the 50s, and of course he was under some constraints as to what he could talk about. McIntyre's book is more recent. I think it was published in 2010. And so it draws on more recently declassified material. Of course, I would recommend that you read both books personally. McIntyre's book, I think, is the first to suggest, though, that Alexis Baron von Roon was a less than loyal Nazi who was not fooled by the mincemeat deception at all. At least he's the first that I know of. I mean, it's entirely possible that there were some other people who put that forth, but he's the first place that I came across this theory was in McIntyre's book. So again, I have to give credit to McIntyre, you know, for
throwing
this little mystery our way. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when the mincemeat intel arrived in Berlin, it was forwarded to FHW, which typically subjected every bit of intelligence to really intense scrutiny, and that was their job.
Yeah.
Now, in this case, they had photos of the letters, plus an inventory and description of every item in Martin's briefcase and everything in his pockets, courtesy of the Spaniards.
Mm-hmm.
And in evaluating the provenance of these letters, it would be logical to follow up on William Martin to see if his backstory checked out.
Yeah, you'd think so, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, one of the items was that letter from Martin's father, J.C. Martin. Not a real guy.
Nope.
And it was written on stationery from the Black Lion Hotel in Mold. That's the name of the town in North Wales. It would have been logical to have an agent in Britain stopped by the hotel to see if J.C. Martin had stayed there. But this was not done.
Yeah.
Every German agent in Britain was under control of MI5, and was under the surveillance of MI5, I should probably say there, right? Isn't that what you're saying?
They were actually under the control of MI5.
Oh, really? They were all under MI5's control.
They turned almost every one of them. There were, I think in the entire history, they captured them, and they basically sat them down and gave them tea and sandwiches and said, basically, here's the thing. You can work for us as a double agent or we'll kill you. And and I think only one or two of the German agents actually refused to cooperate and they were executed.
Yeah.
Everybody else was a double agent. So they basically were in control of these agents. They weren't just surveilling them, and they were sending reports that they had written themselves back to Germany. And the thing about this is where I get back. I'm really wondering if the Abwehr's heart was really in the whole game, because whenever they would infiltrate a new agent into Britain, they would say, "Hey, go contact agent so and so, agent John Doe, at this address, and he'll help you get settled in Britain." Now, this is bad operational practice, I think.
Right.
Yeah, very bad.
You want these guys not to know each other.
Oh, hell yeah. And to know about each other. And, so in essence, the new guy would show up at so-and-so's doorstep, and guess who's waiting for him there? MI5. Mm-hmm. And he had a decision to make, you know, cooperate or be shot. And so, and that made it extremely easy for them to take over the entire German intelligence network in Britain. okay. and controlled the entire thing. And they controlled it completely. It was a major mm-hmm. intelligence okay. success. But I don't think they would have been remotely as successful if the Abwehr hadn't been so incompetent. That was a big help. Yeah.
Right. Well,
anyway, So back to the hotel that Martin's dad stayed at. Yeah. They didn't send an agent by to check on that.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Well, this is a good thing since our plotters kind of dropped the ball on this detail. It would have been ideal mm-hmm. if they just sent a guy to stay at the hotel on the date the letter was written in case someone checked the register later, but they didn't do that.
No.
Someone thought of this later and went to the hotel and wrote J.C. Martin in the register. But it was added in the space at the bottom of the page and the date was out of sequence. So they probably wouldn't have bought that. So it looks like they dodged a bullet there.
Yeah, they did. According to Ben McIntyre, he got a look at a photo of it. He said it looked like Charles Cholmondeley's handwriting. So yeah. I guess at some point they figured, maybe we better look into that. And so he goes up there and but luckily for them, it doesn't look like the Germans checked up on that. And there was another glitch in the details that the people at Foreign Armies West missed, which is that Bill Martin had a pass for the Combined Operations HQ in London, which, of course, he would have needed to go by and pick up those letters, those top secret letters that were in his briefcase, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this pass expired on March 31st, 1943.
Oh.
Which is, which means he shouldn't have been able to get into Combined Operations HQ to pick up those letters. And
mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that it's a little out of character for FHW to miss something like this. Again, you're looking for any teeny little detail that's out of place in the intelligence business. These mm-hmm. guys were very good at this. And yet they didn't notice that there's something wrong there.
Mm-hmm.
But
they could have sent someone to Kuleva to talk to the coroner who examined the body. Because this guy drank rat poison, they probably could have, rat poison is typically like arsenic and other heavy metal derivatives. They probably could have figured out that this guy didn't die in a plane crash.
Yeah, well, I think they were counting on the coroner in Huelva to not have a whole lot in the way of sophisticated equipment to work with. Maybe that could be part
I'm just
of
saying
it.
But then better still, the Germans could have headed down to Huelva or wherever and just gone to the graveyard where Martin was buried and dug up the body.
I know. The Brits were keenly aware of this possibility. So mm-hmm. after the body was buried in a local cemetery in Huelva, and it's still there, by the way, they had somebody go by and lay a wreath of flowers on the grave, carefully noting its position on the grave. And then they had somebody wander by every day or so to see if the wreath had been moved. And it never was. Eventually, they had a heavy marble slab engraved with Bill Martin's fictional details and placed over the grave to make it tough for the Germans to dig it up. And again, they were very careful about this. They actually made up a whole series of communications between the fictional J.C. Martin and Hazelden at the local Spanish consulate, where he asked him and sent him money and everything, saying, please, oh, please, put a good headstone on my son's grave and yada, yada, yada. And so that's another detail that they took care of. And by the way, the grave is still there. As I said, the marble slab has Bill Martin's details on it. In 1996, the actual name of the guy in the grave, Lindur Michael, was uncovered by a journalist who actually an historian. He was going through some old archives and he found the name of the guy, which had been kept a secret for all those many, many years. So he found it, publicized it, and since the cat was out of the bag, the British government in 1997 added some engraving to that marble slab at the bottom with Lindur Michael's name on it as well.
Uh-huh.
A little gesture of respect, for the guy.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, so they didn't dig up the grave.
No.
But if they would have just gone to talk to the coroner, they would have learned some stuff that might have been interesting to them.
Yeah.
For one, the body had been in the water based on the dates of the letters and the theater tickets for 5 days, very most, but it was more decomposed than that.
Yeah.
Also, the doctor, being where he was in the world, had seen plenty of drowning victims. There were typically bites from fish and crabs on them, but Bill Martin's body didn't have any. The hair also becomes brittle after prolonged submersion in salt water, but Martin's hair wasn't.
Yeah. Essentially, yeah, the submarine plunked in the water, and just the very next morning, it was found by that
fisherman. The tide took it straight in. So why weren't these things checked out?
Yeah. I mean, when you consider how important the intel in those letters was, you'd really think that FHW would have done this, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But instead, Lieutenant Colonel Alexis Baron von Rohm, who, by the way, was was known as Hitler's favorite intelligence analyst.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Hitler loved him. He was because he was so good at his job. he wrote an intelligence assessment dated May 11th, 1943, which pretty much regurgitated the contents of the letters. So the Allies were going to invade the Peloponnese, that is, southern Greece, with a smaller invasion of Sardinia and a feint towards Sicily. Von Rohm appeared to completely fall for the letters. He wrote, quote, "The circumstances of the discovery, together with the form and contents of the dispatches, are absolutely convincing proof of the reliability of the letters," unquote.
Okay. Well, so this was strange, right? Yeah. FHW didn't pretty much, they didn't typically take anything from the Abwehr at face value unless it had been corroborated by other evidence.
Yeah.
FHW.
They figured, just like I've been talking about, that the Abwehr wasn't very good at its job. Right?
Right. Right. I mean, the FHW, yeah. I mean, it's kind of like the difference between Army intelligence and, the CIA, right? Like, yeah, good work, guys. We're gonna verify this.
Yeah.
And so the FHW didn't really have a high opinion of the Abwehr in that regard, which you can imagine. So why did Alexis Baron von Rohm throw caution to the wind in this particular case, just this one time, basically?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Also, von Rohm went a step further and suggested that the Germans should stage a deception of their own by pretending to reinforce Sicily.
So yeah, just like the Allies were pretending to reinforce Syria and Egypt, hey, they could do the same thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He didn't want to give away that they'd seen the letters.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So was von Rohm truly fooled, or did he deliberately pass enemy disinformation up the chain of command? According to your guy, Ben McIntyre, he probably wasn't fooled. Von Rohm was another anti-Nazi within the Nazis.
Yeah.
This guy, Hitler, apparently liked him a lot. He had a real high opinion of him.
Von Rohm was from an aristocratic family. He was a monarchist and a Christian. And the monarchist in him detested the Nazis' egalitarian ideology. It was just a little too leveling for him. And the Christian in him was even more appalled by the SS's behavior, especially from early on in the war, starting with the destruction of Poland and going on from there, all the atrocities that he'd been hearing about. And he started turning against the Nazi regime. And he consistently misled Hitler by inflating the strength of British and U.S. armies in Europe. And it's hard to say exactly what he was up to. He was a loyal German. Yes, even if he didn't like the Nazis, he didn't want Germany to be destroyed.
Right.
It's possible that, like other anti-Nazis in Germany, he wanted Germany to lose the war as soon as possible just to stop all the killing and destruction.
Right.
Yeah.
There were a lot of them who felt that they could get control back of the country before, if you could get Hitler out of the way. Right. Mm-hmm. So that it's Germany losing the war, but it's also Hitler losing the war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, another possible motive here too is maybe he wanted to aid the Allied advance because he figured, well, it's looking at this point like we're going to lose the war.
Right.
So who do you want to take over and occupy Germany first? Do you want the Allies or do you want the Russians? And
easy call to make.
Yeah, definitely. Sorry to all of our Russian listeners. I apologize, but yeah.
Less, we'll never really know what von Rohm was thinking. He was swept up in the aftermath of the 20th of July plot to assassinate Adolf Hitler in 1944, which you've all, of course, heard of. That was when Tom Cruise and his buddies decided to blow Hitler up with a bomb.
Yeah.
The movie, the criminally underrated movie Valkyrie, was about this ill-fated plot.
It is a good movie. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
I recommend it.
Von Rohm actually wasn't a part of the plot, though. He knew some of the conspirators. Probably he was suspected of not being as good a Nazi as they wanted him to be. So he was executed in October of 1944 by being hung on a meat hook, which they'd like to do.
Yeah, that sounds like a pretty ugly way to go.
Yeah. No, it's actually, like,
we're not talking hung on the meat hook after he was dead.
No, they put him up there. It's actually a medieval way to kill somebody. But it would have been nice if he survived the war so we could find out what he really thought about those letters and the, you know, Bill Martin.
Yeah, on the dead English courier that they found floating in the ocean. What did he really think about that? Hey, so, all right. So it looks to me like there were a few Germans out there who really could have foiled the mincemeat plan. But they didn't. It appears that way. I mean, obviously, Alexis Baron von Roon was the key one, but also Wilhelm Leisner and perhaps Carl Erich Kuhlenthal. Although the historians, as I said, are still kind of split on him.
Yeah.
And of course, Leisner, I don't know how much he could have foiled the plan because he didn't seem to have a lot of influence.
Right.
Yeah.
So as we should also give a shout out to Mussolini as well.
Yeah.
I don't know how much, if at all, he was briefed on the mincemeat letters. Mussolini was never wavering about his opinion that the Allies were going to attack Sicily. That was where he thought they would come ashore.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Hitler, on the other hand, always believed that they would attack through Greece. So he never really needed much convincing. They were telling him what he wanted to hear.
That's also another key to disinformation campaigns, by the way, is, you know, you're not going to change somebody's mind too radically. The best thing to do is reinforce what he's already inclined to believe.
Right. Confirmation bias. Yeah. Powerful drug. He also, and, you know, he had much of the German high command suspected that the Italians might surrender to the Allies at any time.
Yeah.
If they reinforce Sicily, then Italy surrendered. Presumably, they would lose a lot of men and tanks and other weapons.
And artillery and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the presumption was always against reinforcing Sicily, really.
Yeah, that's true. You know, so so you gotta ask yourself if, you know, just exactly how influential Operation Mincemeat really was. You know, and we also shouldn't overlook the possibility that maybe the Germans actually saw right through the letters. Not, you know, all the way up the chain and everywhere, but they concluded that this effort from the Brits was just a little too amateurish, a little too obvious, and the Allies were trying to trick Germany into thinking that Greece and Sardinia were the real targets. Got it? They know that you know that you know.
Right?
They know that you know. We know.
Back and forth.
So, in other words, the Germans would think those silly limeys. They're trying to make us think that they're going to invade Sicily by staging a transparent op, claiming the opposite. But we, the Germans, are not that dumb.
Yeah.
So maybe that's it. Maybe they're not. Yeah, obviously this is a plant. This is a fake. And this is what they want us to think, that that they're going to invade Sicily. So let's go reinforce Greece.
Yeah. Between your back and forth logic and talk about Sicily, you've got me in Princess Bride spirals. I can't even get out of it.
Yeah. But again, I guess we'll never know for sure. Unfortunately, so many of the people that were involved with this are dead and died in the war and can't be asked about this.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's fascinating to speculate on this. I love these historical intelligence mysteries. Because there is so much of a wilderness of mirrors, so much confusion, that it's just a fun little mind puzzle to think about these things, you know? Again, I really can't be sure. I don't know that the failure of Operation Mincemeat would have necessarily altered the eventual outcome of the war.
Yeah.
I'm sure it would have prolonged it and gotten a lot more Allied soldiers killed. So.
Yeah. I mean, if history's any guide, invading Sicily is hard. It's a tough little island to get to. Clearing a path for the Allied soldiers by distracting the already kind of overstretched Italian and German militaries probably saved a whole lot of lives and sped up the taking of the Italian peninsula.
And then,
but I don't think it would have changed the outcome of World War II.
No, like I said, it's like Bletchley Park and Bletchley Park. He tried to say, you know, and the Enigma thing, a lot of people have credited that with winning the war. It didn't really. The historians figure that it shortened the war, but it didn't really win the war. Same thing here. It was still a stellar operation, well carried off, and you know, if it just saved some lives on our side, then that's good enough for me.
Well, yeah. It's, I mean, it's not like it was like a particularly expensive operation. It didn't take much at all to pull this off. And it probably had a really, I mean, it probably for what it cost and how much time it took probably was a good deal for the Brits.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. It was. Yeah. And it does appear to have worked. And although, again, probably wouldn't have worked if there hadn't been some people in, you know, in the intelligence apparatus in Germany who really, you know, didn't want Germany to win anyway.
You think, okay, I want to posit just one final theory though.
Yeah.
Maybe they weren't like, ah, this is part of our diabolical plan to, you know, screw Hitler over and speed the fall of Nazi Germany. Maybe they just didn't give a damn.
Well, you know, it's also possible too. You shouldn't overlook the sort of just of the fear aspect of things. I mean, it was probably known to especially to von Rohn, it was that Hitler was already leaning towards the invasion of Greece. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think a lot of people, when they're confronted with the evil dictator, they don't want to really contradict right. him, you know.
That's kind of what I'm saying. They just didn't want to have to swim upstream on this one.
Yeah, exactly. They just figured, well, you know, it's like, you know, if I could really piss Hitler off and I don't want to do that. So I'm just, yeah. And frankly, yeah. It was, yeah. And frankly, you know, it was kind of a coin toss. Is this true? Is it not true? Well, let's just do what Hitler wants. We'll just do that, you know?
It's just not rock the boat, man. I don't need to get hung on a meat hook.
Exactly. Yeah. So anyway, a fascinating story. And do check out the movie when it comes out. And there was also another movie that came out in the 50s, I think 1956 or 7.
Yeah, I think that sounds right. Yeah, 1956.
Yeah, The Man Who Never Was, which was based on Ewan Montague's book of the same name, came out.
I've seen it a bunch of times. I absolutely adore this movie. It's so good.
Yeah, I hate to admit this. I have not seen the movie. I got to see it.
Yeah.
It stars Clifton Webb as Ewan Montague. And here's the hilarious part is Ewan Montague had a cameo in the movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where he confronts he confronts Clifton Webb playing himself. Anyway, well, I think that's hilariously awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Do that. Oh yeah. No, I think that is amazing. And with that, I think we should probably sign off.
No, we probably should. And of course, you know, don't forget Operation Mincemeat, the movie starring Colin Firth, among other people. It's got a good cast in it. I see.
Looks good, but definitely, if you can, check out The Man Who Never Was. It's really good.
Absolutely. Check out that movie, too. The two books are Operation Mincemeat by Ben McIntyre and The Man Who Never Was by Ewan Montague. You should read those, too, if you want to know more about this.
Definitely.
And that's about it. Do you got any more theories or thoughts?
Nope, that's it.
Yeah, same here. Anyway, I hope you guys enjoyed this little mystery. And, of course, stay tuned for information about how to find us via email and social media and all that good stuff. And, of course, the usual plea. Please to leave us a good rating and review
wherever
you might be
so
downloading this podcast from or streaming it from. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We would like that.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Please give us a review. It means the world to us and we read them all. I read them all.
Absolutely. Yeah. And even the crappy reviews, we don't like those, but sometimes you might learn something. You never know.
Definitely.
I don't want you to take that as an invitation, by the way, to leave us a lousy review. Don't do that.
Oh, leave us a good one.
Yes. Leave us a glowing review. And if you have anything negative to say, send us an email. How's that sound?
That sounds good, right.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Anyway, till next week, folks. What will they say? Auf Wiedersehen.
The Shocking Details can be found at www.theshockingdetails.com. We're on Twitter at Shocking Details. For discussion of episodes and more, our Facebook group is facebook.com/groups/shockingdetailspodcast/. Or you can email us at theshockingdetailspodcast@gmail.com. And if you like the podcast, please consider giving us a like and a positive review and letting people know about us.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.